Welcome back to the Active Measures Newsletter Podcast. I'm Jim Lubis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University.
And I'm Mark Jacobson, non-resident fellow at the Pell Center.
Mark, it's great to be with you again, and I'm really excited about this week's conversation. There's a lot of stuff. We were off last week because of the Memorial Day holiday, so there's 2 weeks of stuff worth talking about. But we've got a special guest tonight, Patrick Tucker from Defense One, who does some great reporting on this stuff. He's going to join us at the end of the show, and I think we're going to have plenty to talk about with him, too.
That's great, and happy D-Day week to you.
Happy D-Day.
The anniversary of D-Day.
Yeah, remarkable. I got to start off in the interest of time tonight. There were two stories, a short read and a long read. The New York Times had it as "Once a Sheriff's Deputy in Florida, Now a Source of Disinformation from Russia." That was by Stephen Lee Myers. And the folks at NewsGuard had a much longer takedown of this. It's called "The Fugitive Florida Deputy Sheriff Who Became a Kremlin Disinformation Impresario." This is about John Mark Dugan, a 51-year-old former deputy sheriff in Palm Beach County, Florida. He fled criminal charges in 2016 and found sanctuary in Russia. Now, with the help of artificial intelligence, he currently operates a network of 160 fake websites designed to look like legitimate news sites in the United States, the United Kingdom, and France. And those sites include outlets that sound very, very proper and official, like Clear Story News, Miami Chronicle, Infos Independentes, en français, s'il vous plaît, The London Crier, The New York News Daily, The London Chronicle, and DC Weekly, among many others. He's using commercially available AI to produce original content rapidly and inexpensively, and many of his stories sound like Russian information warriors wrote them. For example, his sites were some of the first to circulate the story that there were U.S. funded biolabs in Ukraine prior to the start of this most recent invasion of Ukraine by Russia. He published the false claim in the San Francisco Chronicle that Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky had smuggled 300 kilograms of cocaine out of Argentina. In the Boston Times, and we should note, these stories are all bogus, right? And these outlets are all bogus. But in the Boston Times, he published a story claiming that the CIA was working with Ukraine to defeat Donald Trump. That's a story that we talked about just a couple of weeks ago. They also reported that Zelensky and his family were buying luxury yachts and jewelry, and that Prince Andrew, brother of King Charles of Britain, had abducted and abused children during a secret visit to Ukraine. So, you know, his tradecraft is interesting. It's sophisticated. He shows evidence of narrative laundering. Claims appear first on a public social media site like X or YouTube. They get picked up by bogus sites like the ones that Mr. Dugan operates. And then they get picked up by Russian state media without any reference to the strange, to the origins of these claims. So, look, this has been reported on now by NewsGuard, by Recorded Future, by the New York Times, and by the folks at Clemson University's Media Forensics Hub. This is an example of what one individual can do with the aid of AI, and it's something that we're going to have to keep an eye on as we get closer to Election Day.
So, Jim, what I want to focus on this week are human beings. So, of course, I am going to start with an article about AI. Anyway, it's a new report from Anthropic. Now, this is OpenAI's in-house safety group, kind of like the superego, if OpenAI is the id, if we want to be Freudian about it. So the report details Anthropic's work over the past several months in disrupting covert influence operations that sought to use AI models for various nefarious tasks, such as generating comments and longer articles, creating fake names and bios for social media accounts, open source research, debugging code, and translating and proofreading text. So, pretty mundane stuff for the most part, but all being done by AI. Now, Anthropic disrupted five major influence operations, including a Russian operation dubbed Bad Grammar that targeted Ukraine, Moldova, the Baltics, and the U.S. And they were using the Anthropic OpenAI's models to create short political comments and post them on Telegram. There was also a Russian doppelganger operation you and I have talked about before. This largely had the tools were largely used for translation and editing. And then the Chinese Spamouflage network, which they use the OpenAI system to research public social media, generating texts in Chinese, English, Japanese, and Korean across platforms like Twitter, Medium, and Blogspot. Of course, the Iranians had a role. Their International Union of Virtual Media was trying to generate long-form articles, And so again, Anthropic stopped them as well. And then the Israelis had a commercial company called Stoic, STOIC. And this was they were caught generating articles and comments on the war in the Middle East, which were posted on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and associated websites. So again, using AI for the Ukraine war, Gaza conflict, the Indian elections, different political situations in Europe and the U.S., and of course to help to help block criticisms of the Chinese government. It doesn't appear as though any of the operations had great impact, but it's still wonderful that Anthropic was able to identify them. So the report is only about 31 pages long, so it's worth a read. There's an exec summary of a few pages. But one of the things that struck me was in using the, in terms of defensive trends, the one that struck me in the report was the persistent human element of error despite AI assistance. So I told you this was going to be about human beings. I really gravitated that because AI can change the toolkit that human operators use, but as the report points out, it doesn't change the operators themselves. You know, basically, what was happening was AI was doing things that exposed the content as AI generated, making mistakes, wrong captions for videos, or poor website tags. So the bottom line is we really shouldn't lose sight of the human limitations that can affect these AI operations and decision making.
I think that's fair. You know, our guest coming up in a little bit has done some reporting this week too about how Russia and China are using OpenAI for disinformation. But, you know, there are other stories. You know, every week it seems like we've got more and more reporting about how AI is being deployed in the disinformation space. I'm actually, impressed that OpenAI is doing some reporting on this themselves. I think that's an important step forward.
I think it's important. I mean, they're recognizing that technology is a tool. It's not a savior. I mean, you know, we've seen all sorts of companies, Bellingcat's one of my favorites, using reverse image search and bot detection to help identify disinformation. But it's technology is not the panacea. And, you know, whether it's good journalists on the ground, tracking down stories to see, you know, to help prevent misinformation, or the human beings creating the algorithms, or the or getting involved in protecting against disinformation. Again, you know,
but you know,
tools are tools,
and I think that's a great point, because the there will be something after AI, right? I'm not smart enough to know what it is, but there will be something after AI that's the next thing. That is the next vector for someone to exploit disinformation. This is as old as warfare. This is as old as disagreement between people. It's as old as humanity wanting to influence somebody else. And it's not going away.
No, as I like to say, the snake was the first propagandist, the first purveyor of disinformation, and Eve was the first student of disinformation. So it goes way back, right? Right back to the Garden of Eden.
Well, that's a tough segue, Mark, but let's go to tonight's guest. Joining us now is Patrick Tucker. He's the science and technology editor at Defense One. He's also previously the author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. He's got a rich history when it comes to matters of technology. He's also one of the best reporters working right now on the issue of disinformation. And he had an article on May 24th in Defense One that caught both Mark and my attention. The headline, Losing Hearts and Minds, the Desperate State of U.S. Influence Operations. Patrick Tucker, thank you for being with us tonight.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You know, so we were chatting a little bit before we got started, and Mark and I were both telling you that this article caught both of our attentions for a couple of different reasons. But before we get into some of the discussion, why don't you provide just a really quick overview about what you found and what you reported?
Well, thanks. So every year I go to a Special Operations Forces conference out in Tampa. My friend Stu Braden with the Global South Foundation holds it. And this year they had a big panel of folks that work in the MISO community, what used to be called psychological operations, and it is today called MISO. And I think a lot of people don't. It's a big area of interest for me because psychological operations is an area that Russia clearly and China devote a ton of budget to, prioritize really heavily. And in the United States, you can fit like a large cross-section of the expert practitioners in the space literally in this room at the Tampa Convention Center. And so you had Daniel Kimmage from the State Department, who was at one point the head of the Global Engagement Center. That's the State Department's kind of operation into there. You had James Hawley, who's with the Defense Department, newly stood up office there. You had a variety of different folks from the community. And basically the refrain was all the same, that right now the United States is in an absolutely terrible position in order to compete in this area. And you can see that in terms of how we're prioritizing budget too. So even as we talk, the Senate Armed Services Committee, the House Armed Services Committee will hold hearings where they discuss the incredible importance of this area. But at the same time, right now, as your listeners might know, the United States Army is considering a 10% cut to special operations forces specifically in this area. The Global Engagement Center at the State Department is looking at extensive cuts. So it's they were talking about all of these things in the context of where we are right now, the possibility of us falling a little bit further behind. So I talked to a bunch of them. And I talked a little bit with Periton, who is the recipient of about a $900 million contract to understand where the United States is right now from a military perspective in terms of influence operations and where this entire field is going because of advances in emerging technology, like artificial intelligence, clearly. And, you know, it's what strikes me, what sort of struck me and sort of prompted me to write this is just the unanimity of voice on this among people that actually sort of risk a little bit when they come out and they talk about our current position, because it's for the most part, the military likes to hear stories about how well they're doing, challenges easily overcome. And that's just sort of not the sentiment on this issue right now. So after kind of surveying everybody that I could, and I've covered this and talking to a few people for years now, this is really just the latest chapter in that marks a trend that's been going on for some time. And it's growing in importance, but that doesn't that growth and importance does not align with budget prioritization. It doesn't align with concentration in government. So that was kind of the message that I got from that.
You know, Patrick, one of the lines that absolutely, you know, hit me and stopped me cold as I was reading this, and I'm quoting you here, the unanimous verdict from the folks at this conference, quote, "We're doing miserably, especially in comparison to China and Russia." And you go on to spin some of that out and note that some of the challenge stems from a question about whether or not the U.S. government should be engaged in influencing perceptions, influence campaigns at all. Can you unpack a little of that reticence for us?
Right. Well, so exactly. So there's a reason that MISO falls within a subcategory of special operations forces. There's seen as something that's probably necessary in certain areas where you need to understand the local population in order to achieve a operational objective in a very limited way. And the United States, we are a democracy. We're a functioning democracy. We have a fourth estate. I'm a proud, you know, happy member of that monastic tradition. And if you have elected officials that have to go out and they rely on the population to elect them, they have to theoretically be truthful. When they're not truthful, the fourth estate holds them accountable. There's a big, I think, very natural, very sort of patriotic reluctance to embrace the idea that the United States should be engaged in something like influence warfare. And you see that, I think, really clearly when you look at, for instance, the Biden administration's effort to stand up just a kind of like defense board on foreign-based disinformation to kind of market and tag it when it was beginning to percolate online, it was seen as incredibly political, and it got off the ground for about 2 seconds, and it was shut down within like 6 weeks. So we're in comparison, for instance, to a country like Estonia, right, which has a much more kind of like unified national identity, which is good or bad, depending. I like our pluralistic society, but in part because of that, but also because of their long experience with the Soviet Union, they have in Estonia a board made up of citizens that helps to kind of monitor the information environment that regular Estonians are exposed to for the possibility of basically an influence campaign from the Russians. And that's something that's inconceivable in the United States. And so part of the issue right now is that we can't talk about the importance of influence campaigning because we aren't yet aware or willing to state out loud as a society how vulnerable we are to it and how easily we're kind of falling into that trap. Like there are, you have US politicians, and it's actually not specific to party. You have this on both sides that are willing to campaign on the basis of foreign, primarily Russian efforts to influence the American population. And it's very hard to help really anybody in elected office feel comfortable to talk about this meaningfully. And the United States military, I mean, my gosh, like the last thing that they want to do is try and sound political. So they have to, even though they're in charge of this area, they talk about it in very specific operational terms. The State Department, too, has this global engagement center, and they're terrified that it will be perceived as overly political, especially if administrations change. And so it's been hamstrung really from day one.
You know, Patrick, it strikes me that so much of this goes back to the fights that, frankly, were had after the end of the Second World War, where the journalism community and government work hand in hand to deal with an existential threat. But also during the Cold War as well, of course, at the end of that, the takedown of USIA, the atrophying of our DOD and State Department, and even our CIA influence capacity. So I have two questions for you. The first is, where's the blame to fall in terms of cutting psychological operations or MISO in the U.S. military? I mean, it sounds like the U.S. SOCOM wants more troops, understands the need for them for general conflict and not the counterinsurgencies of the past 20 years. Who's arguing to make these cuts?
Right. Well, so that comes from Randy George, the chief of the Army. They did a this is something we've also covered a little bit. And they go back to a CAPE study that was conducted that showed that basically Special Operations Forces was a little bureaucracy heavy. So they were going to do broad cuts across Special Operations Forces, and they really emphasized, because as soon as they made this announcement, it became incredibly controversial very quickly. They said, we're going to cut some folks working in the bureaucracy layers. You don't need to have like five different headquarters for stuff. We're not going to cut the door kickers, no kicking of like the operational teams, the alpha teams. That's not going to happen. Your actual operators are safe and secure. We're just going to cut some folks in the logistics area. And that turns out, lo and behold, to be a potential big cut to MISO. And again, it's like it's a very small part. So right now that falls to the Army. But the reason the Army justifies this is because they're having this recruitment challenge, and this is how they figured out how to do it. So how to deal with that recruitment challenge. Obviously, there's a lot of folks saying, hey, listen, if you can't get the billets, just move people from elsewhere in the Army into these critical roles. Like the entire future of the infantry, as we understand it now, is kind of based on an expeditionary soft model, right? You have smaller teams, mesh networked, more independently capable, as opposed to great big old battalions. It's kind of a throwback to the last wars. If the future of the infantry is based on soft, then why are you like, you know, what is the meaning behind this? So, yeah, it's basically that. And at the same time, though, you know, everybody has, Randy George, the chief of staff of the Army, his superiors are the Biden administration and the National Security Council. And they seem OK with it. They seem OK with this. And it's kind of mind boggling to a lot of folks. So in terms of where the buck stops, it really sort of stops with Jake Sullivan and the National Security Agency, who's saying, OK, I guess we're going to cut MISO, and Randy George, whose idea this was in the beginning, basically.
Let me ask you, you see some innovation at the tactical level. Maybe we'll start including psychological operations personnel, MISO personnel on SFODAs and things like that. But you've just raised a big point about the national level. We have DOD, DHS, state, and CIA, but we all know the NSC doesn't coordinate operations the way it did during the Cold War. We can all thank Ollie North for that. But is there any talk about an NCTC-style arrangement so we can really either do offensive or defensive influence operations or counter influence operations on a national scale? Is there any discussion along those lines?
And you noted, Patrick, in the piece that we're talking about, that the White House still is not really well organized for these kinds of operations.
No, the White House is not well organized for these sorts of things. I mean, you have too many different folks that are in charge of their own silo. And so the idea of them coordinating with one another to then arrive at a centralized authority that might govern them all and be effective, it's kind of like asking the cats to not only herd themselves, but also elect a ruler or a governor. And it's not really what like cats do, you know, it's not really what anybody does except, I don't know, ants or something, maybe, I don't know. But not well organized for this. There is some talk within the US that maybe MISO should move under the Secretary of Intelligence, DOD Intelligence, Moultrie, but that's just sort of like a thought that has surfaced that some people are talking about. But in terms of an expanded, coordinated approach to influence. The feeling very much is, well, we have people that go and stand in front of the podium, they answer questions from the press, from the international press, and that should be enough. And the problem is that, it's really actually something very existential. It goes to how we all understand truth and reality in the year 2024, as we absorb it in snippets from our phones. We each survive and live very much whether we want to or not, and you can be conscientious about it or not, but we live in a filter bubble. And that reality that is just very easily exploited by any adversary that wants to micro-target very specific content to any one of us, consistently replenish our capacity for outrage and move that to some sort of political advantage. And then at some point, sway people to believe things that are fundamentally not true. For instance, about the war in the Middle East, obviously about the Ukrainians, as we just discussed, about the origins of COVID-19, which there was a concerted Chinese and Russian effort to create the impression through U.S. social media networks that the United States had invented COVID-19. Just the nature in which humanity now absorbs information and creates cognitive perceptions is no longer going to accommodate people standing at podiums resting on their title and office to convey credibility. So that's much bigger than U.S. Army MISO getting 10% LOP or the Global Engagement Center or any of that. That really speaks to a fundamental kind of vulnerability in democracy, in democratic systems.
Patrick, we're just about out of time, but listening to you here, I'm mindful that, and you wrote about this in the Losing Hearts and Minds article, that so much of the content that our adversaries might produce can actually be hyper-individualized. Right. And that's the way we consume all of our content right now. So that's one big trend that's been with us, with the advent of social media, something that I call, precision guided munitions of the mind. Yeah. But on the other big trend, though, is this rise of AI and disinformation at scale being produced by artificial intelligence, particularly large language models. In the couple of minutes that we have left here, you had some reporting this past week about how Russia, China, are using OpenAI for disinformation. Can you just give us a taste of that?
Yes. Well, and so importantly, the report does come from OpenAI. It actually comes from Ben Nemo, who for your audience might remember from the Atlantic Council, is actually a great researcher. And not surprisingly, OpenAI found that Russia and China are using their tool in order to make social media content and posts sound much more convincing, much more targeted, and basically to create spam and the illusion that lots of people are commenting on something and reaching a consensus that they aren't. It's all robotic. Right now, it's not had a ton of impact, but that's very much where this is going. And it really gets to your question. And you know what, just very quickly, the thing about this is that the United States can do this very well. If you talk to MISO operators, and I remember specifically around, there was a MISO operation around 2012 targeting the Lord's Resistance Army they these operators very specifically targeted folks that were around Kony, the leader of that guerrilla group, with specific messages, audio messages, verbal messages from their families, asking them to like to leave, creating conditions of attrition through psychological campaigning. This is stuff we can do. We don't know yet why or how or the context where it's appropriate for us, but we can do it. So we won't be on our back foot forever, but we better find our footing really quickly. And there's some big philosophical questions to answer before we can.
Hey, Patrick Tucker, this is a really rich conversation. I feel like we could talk to you all night. That's all the time we have right now, but we hope you'll come back and join us again another time.
Yeah, anytime, guys. Thanks for having me.
So demoralizing that these are the same fights from 20 years ago, from 30 years ago, 40, 50 years ago. I mean, you've got to have someone who's, they have 8 million special assistants to the president,
yeah,
but you don't have a separate special assistant to the president. And now, remember before, that's not even enough anymore. Now you need to make it a deputy national security advisor because now you have, now you have two of those. Because you needed a higher rank than senior special assistant.
You need someone who has access to and the confidence of the president, right? Yeah. And you also need an understanding that disinformation, information, influence campaigns, we got to think about it, understand what really it is we're talking about. And let's just go back to Clausewitz, right? War is the continuation of politics by other means. Politics is the continuation of war by other men. And this is the what I fear is not appreciated in official Washington today and hasn't been for a really long time, that this is a instrument of statecraft. These are not dirty tricks. It doesn't even have to be disinformation. It just has to be information. It has to be influence. This is what the United States did much better than their Soviet adversaries in the Cold War. And so I'm going to get back up on my horse and I'm going to go back to C.D. Jackson, special assistant to the president for Cold War activities in the Eisenhower administration. I'm going to go back to the creation of the U.S. Information Agency. I'm going to go back to the Operations Coordinating Board. We know how to do this, but we've got to understand our own history and understand what the threat actually is.
Yeah, and this is where my focus is on the bureaucratic politics of all this. The Army, as a proponent for psychological operations in the military or as part of the U.S. government, is an insufficient backer. They don't care about loudspeakers, leaflets, media training, who can do the latest, use the latest Adobe suite, editing suites and things like that. No, tanks and guns, because there's constituencies in the districts. And this goes... this goes back. The same arguments were had over 20 years ago at the end of the 90s when there was a realization that psychological operations were being taxed so much. They were a low density, high demand outfit. They were needed for every minor contingency. And I think the problem is that they're getting caught up in this, hey, we're never going to do an insurgency again, so we don't really need any of the special operations stuff.
Except and that's it, ridiculous.
It just misreads the history of psychological operations in the U.S. military, which hits its apex during the Second World War, and from there on, has been fighting for its own existence. And again, this is why I wonder sometimes: are we organized right? Should this be a joint activity that has sort of the proponent type of proponencies that JSOC has in that world, where people know how to fund it, they leave it alone, the services contribute what they can. And again, I with SOLIC now a service-like activity like never before, and SOCOM there, that then maybe there needs to be adjustments to how DOD is doing this. And then again, to my point with Patrick, maybe you need an NCTC style organization to handle all this. I'm not.
You need sure something that is sort of fusing all that stuff across the different elements of government, right? It can't just be a task for the Department of Defense, because a lot of this is not the kinetic space that DOD is comfortable in. It can't all be state. It can't all be the intel community. This needs to be a joint interagency whole of government approach. You know, I was thinking about what you said about low density, high demand. I remember back in the 90s hearing that phrase and somebody saying, yeah, that's just fancy language for we bought the wrong stuff.
And we continue to buy the wrong stuff. What, 5-10 JSFs F-35s could pay for this whole thing?
Yeah. Hey, Mark, we're out of time. This is the Active Measures Newsletter. I'm Jim Lutis.
And I'm Mark Jacobson.
We hope you'll join us again next time.